The Eastern Municipal Water District Board of Directors meeting to order, this being November the 18th, 2020, time being 9 a.m. Director Polly, would you lead us in the flag salute, please?
Be happy to. If we could stand, please, face the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay. This being a virtual meeting, and we have some directors that will be on the phone, could we have a roll call, please?
Sure. Director Polly?
Present.
Director Slauson?
Here.
Director Record?
Here.
Director Corona?
Here.
We have council present?
Yes.
Thank you. All right. This being the, go to agenda item one, which is for public comments. Let me ask April, do we have any guests this morning?
We don't have any guests in the room. We may have guests on the phone.
Okay. Do we have any guests on the phone this morning that would like to introduce themselves? If you do and you need to unmute, please press star six. Okay. Hearing none. We'll go to agenda. This is being the time and the place for any jurisdiction of EMWD. Speakers are required to limit comments to 3 minutes. Any members of the public wishing to speak, please unmute your phone to star six. There have been some adjustments made to the audio equipment. If you're having trouble hearing the speakers, please speak up and let us know. Okay. Hearing none, we'll go to agenda item two, which is we want to postpone these recognitions.
Yes, President Sullivan, members of the board, the two recognitions that we have are for Rich Haller in his retirement. Rich has called in this morning. He's not feeling well and asked if we could postpone this to a future meeting, which we will do. And then the proclamation recognizing George Johnson at the County of Riverside. We were scheduling that for time certain at 10 a.m.
Terrific. Thank you. All right. With that, we have Paul, is the general manager's report, please.
Thank you, President Sullivan, members of the board. Good morning. I just do a sound check. I want to make sure those on the phone, directors, can hear me. Director Corona and Director Record?
Yeah, sounds good, Paul. Okay, much better.
Great. Thank you very much. A couple items to report. My written report's included in your board package. I just want to emphasize a couple of things. First, starting out on the federal level, we've received news that the House of Representatives and Senate Committees of Jurisdiction appear to be advancing a lame duck session WERDA package. There was some question of whether that was going to go forward this year. We did receive some news that what they're looking at in the most recent reports are saying that it excludes some of the more challenging sections under the Clean Water Act that were included in some of the four WERDA bills that have been advanced to date. And actually that the package that's being negotiated appears to focus exclusively on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers provisions. The benefit for that is it makes a cleaner WERDA package overall that can more readily get through Congress. And then secondarily, the benefit for us is that within the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers provisions on both the Senate and House versions of the original bills, EMWD's proposed $25 million authorization modification for the South Paris Desalination Program was included. So our hope is if they focus the WERDA negotiations through the conference committee on the U.S. Army Corps of Engineer provisions only, that we will be able to advance forward. So hope springs eternal. The conference committee is currently working, and we're hearing that they may have release compromise bill language before Thanksgiving. So we'll have some news on that hopefully fairly soon. Under other activities, our State of the District event is, of course, being done virtually this year. Today at 1 p.m., we will actually be releasing and hosting the virtual State of the District program. Of course, many of the board members participated in the production of that. And so that will be basically launched at 1 p.m. and also included on all our social media channels and our websites. And we will get you a link for that if you want to see what the end product of that was. But I did have a chance to look at it. I thought it was very good and reflected well on the district. Items of interest to the board. It's interesting. An item we are tracking that was on the Board of Supervisors meeting yesterday. It was placed on there to introduce a topic, and the proposal that's being put on the agenda for a more detailed workshop on December 15th is to develop an unincorporated community initiative and funding program. Specifically, Supervisor Jeffries is advancing this concept. The idea is the proposal would target 40 disadvantaged communities and neighborhoods in unincorporated county and have an annual process to identify infrastructure deficiencies and needs for those areas. It also includes an examination of water and sewer services for those areas, and the county is proposing the establishment of what they call an unincorporated community fund that would be budgeted out of through the general fund and also out of net revenues of the county would go into the fund to be able to fund some of these public infrastructure improvements and also provide matching funding for grants, as well as they're discussing a potential low or no interest loan program. And some of those would be applicable potentially for things like connection fees. So the Board of Supervisors also states that their existing municipal advisory councils that they have set up through the unincorporated county may be a way to be publicly disseminating information and getting feedback. But again, this is a concept. The board letter was rather short. And the action was to schedule a workshop, a more detailed workshop on this proposal on December 15th. Because of the implications to water and sewer, we'll certainly be tracking that, and we'll report back to the board once we hear more about this program. With that, that concludes my report, unless there are any questions.
Okay. Do you have any questions? Hearing none.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Laura?
Nothing today.
Okay. Nick?
Nothing today. Thank you.
Okay, Joe.
Good morning. Nothing today.
Jeff.
I have nothing. Thank you.
He was. Amazing. COVID's got us all, huh? With that, let's go to the consent calendar, item number four. I'll accept a motion and a second for approvals of 4A through 4J.
I'd move approval.
Mr. President, Steve Corona, I have a conflict of interest on item H, the Woodside item, potential litigation with my family in Woodside. I would make a motion to approve the rest of the consent calendar.
Okay.
I will second that.
All right. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. With that, let's go to 4H, and we understand that Director Corona will be abstaining for a potential conflict of interest. I'll accept a motion and a second.
I will move approval.
I'll second.
Been moved and seconded.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously with the note that Director Corona has abstained. Let's go to agenda item 5, which is the action calendar. 5A is to approve and adopt proposed resolution amending salary schedule of ranges and classifications and salary schedule in accordance with the Memorandum of Understandings provisions. Hi, Laura.
Good morning.
Morning.
This item is before you to adopt an amended salary schedule that is within the approved MOU, which the board approved in April of 2020. The MOU currently has an effective date of March 29th, 2020 through December 31st, 2021. Within that MOU, there were two provisions that were included. One was for a cost of living, or COLA, and a one-time 3% adjustment to the salary schedule based on the elimination of a legacy program or a pay-for-performance program that has been in place. The first item, cost of living adjustment, is based on an average change between 12 months and between November of last year to September of this year, and that resulted in a 2.1% increase in the salary schedule. That will have an effective date of December 20th, and the second provision is, again, within the approved provisions of the MOU, is a 3% adjustment to the salary schedule effective January 3rd, which in return eliminates a legacy program that had been in place since 1999, goes way back. That was a pay-for-performance program, which provided for up to a 10% lump sum payment to employees based on their base annual salary and based on their rating. So the intent of that program was to incentivize employees financially, but in return, there were some unintended consequences like administratively burdensome program, as well as some differences between supervisors and the employees. And most public agencies no longer have any of these programs. So in consideration of all these things, there was an agreement between the district and the union during MOU negotiations to eliminate this program. The 3% adjustment is a one-time adjustment, which will occur in January. And all these items, the funding for these items are provided within the already approved biannual budget. Happy to answer any questions.
Do you have any questions of the floor?
I have no questions.
Any questions from Director Record or Corona?
No.
With that, I'll accept the motion in a second.
I'll move the item, Mr. President.
I will second the item.
It's been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Thank you. Let's go to 5B, which is adopt a proposed resolution of issuance of the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District acting as the legislative body of Community Facilities District Number 2012-61, which is Autumn Winds, authorizing the issuance of its 2020 special tax bonds and approving bond documents as to form.
Morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. Happy to be here today to present two items for consideration. Both items are related to CFD bond issuances. Many members of the financing team have joined us on the call, some of which may have joined after the introduction. Just want to take a moment to personally thank the financing team for all the work they've done on these two items. We have members from our special tax consultant, Webb Municipal Finance. We have our municipal advisor, Fieldman Rolop and Associates. And then we also have district staff that's joined us, as well as underwriter teams at Raymond James and Associates and Piper Sandler and Company. The first item is for CFD number 2012-61, Autumn Winds. The CFD was formed back in May of 2013, and then last year, the rate and method of apportionment was modified to change the name of the CFD and also include some valley-wide recreation and park district improvements. The CFD was formed for the purpose of financing EMWD water and sewer improvements and is authorized an aggregate principal amount not to exceed $4 million. The developer for both of these projects is KB Home, and the CFD for this CFD may only issue bonds in the future for refinancing purposes. The CFD is located in Director Pauly's division in Winchester, and it's located between Leon Road and Winchester Road. The CFD is approximately 32 acres and is planned for 141 single-family homes. KB Home owns more than 20% of the properties, and so per our the district's comprehensive debt policy, we're requiring a letter of credit to be posted in case there's any significant delinquencies. Once ownership falls below 20%, then the LOC will be released. As we've done with all of the bond sales we've brought before the board since COVID-19 back in March, we requested an independent appraisal be conducted on the property to ensure that the property values haven't been negatively affected by COVID-19. Happy to report this appraisal for this property, which was conducted by Kittisino and Associates, came in at approximately
Mr. President, since there's a pause, I need to abstain on this and the next item because of potential conflict of interest, KB Home, my company is currently working for.
Okay. Thank you. Let the record show that Director Slauson has left the podium.
Apologies for the delay. The appraisal came in at approximately $41 million. Which brought the value-to-lien ratio to 11 to 1. The value-to-lien ratio exceeds the district's requirement of 4 to 1. The underwriter for this bond issue will be Raymond James and Associates. The pricing is expected to take place on December 3rd, and the true interest cost is estimated at 3.4%. Projected par amount is about $3.5 million. And staff recommends approval of this item, which will adopt the proposed resolution, approve the related documents, and authorize the district's executive team to effect issuance of the bonds. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I must just be clear that because they're not meeting our 150 home threshold, that's the reason for the letter of credit, correct?
Not specifically, no, but the letter of credit does help mitigate some risk. So this project is planned for 141 homes.
Okay.
Our analysis, Webb Municipal Finance and the district staff put together, shows that this CFD doesn't produce any significant cash flow issues. That is, the number of delinquency payments for this one to cause concern would be similar to that of 150 units. Therefore, the staff is recommending approval of this item.
Okay.
The LOC just assists in mitigating the risk, and any time a developer owns more than 20% of the property, we require it per our comprehensive policy.
Okay. Great. There's okay. No questions. I'll move the item, Mr. President.
Okay. Can I get a second, please?
I'll second.
Been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan.
Aye.
Director Polly.
Aye.
Director Record.
Aye.
Director Crona.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously 4-0 with Director Slauson out with a potential conflict of interest. Let's go to 5C, which is adopt a proposed resolution of issuance of the Board of Directors of Eastern Municipal Water District acting as the legislative body of Community Facilities District number 2016-72, which is the Hidden Hills Project, authorizing the issuance of its 2020 special tax bonds and approving bond documents as to form. Thomas.
Thank you. This is the second item up for the board's consideration today. This CFD, CFD number 2016-72, Hidden Hills, was formed in June 2016 with a bonded indebtedness not to exceed $4 million. CFD was formed for the purpose of financing EMWD water and sewer improvements. This CFD is located in Director Sullivan's division in the city of Menifee on the southeast corner of Murrieta Road and Craig Avenue, just a few miles from the high school there. KB Home is also the developer of this project, and the project's planned for a total of 397 homes. And there are two neighborhoods within the project, one known as Cypress at Hidden Hills and the other known as Pepper Tree at Hidden Hills. What we did early on this year, as we had a number of CFD bond issues up for consideration, when COVID-19 started, we decided to prioritize the items we would be bringing forward to the board in order to enable the most amount of property owners savings on their property tax bills. On the two today, this one, 397 homes, and then the one that we just discussed, 141 homes, both of which are owned by KB Home. We use the same appraiser on both, and which allowed for some economies of scale and efficiencies during the process. The appraisal came in at approximately $116.8 million, which brought the value-to-lien ratio to 22-1, which greatly exceeds the district's 4-1 requirement. Because KB Home also owns more than 20% of the property, a letter of credit is also being required per our policy. And again, once the ownership falls below 20%, the LOC will be released. The effective tax rate on this one is 1.87, which also meets our guidelines at 2% max. And the financing is projected to be approximately $2.3 million, with an estimated true interest cost of 3.35%, subject to market conditions. We're still seeing very good interest rates, which will be very efficient as far as financing these improvements. The underwriter for this transaction is Piper Sandler & Company, and pricing is expected to occur on December 2nd. Staff recommends approval of this item, which will approve the resolution, the related documents, and authorize the district's executive team to effect the issuance of the bonds. I'd be happy to answer any questions on this one.
Directors have any questions of Thomas on this item?
Director Rickard moves approval.
I'll second it.
Been moved and seconded. Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Rickard?
Aye.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Thank you. Motion passes unanimously 4-0 with Director Slauson out with a potential conflict of interest.
Director Sullivan, if I may, just want to personally thank you for all of your support over the years, supporting, encouraging, showing interest in this program. As we showed a few weeks ago, the CFD, or the district's land secured program, has really proved and provided a lot of economic value to the region. And we really started this program back in 2001. I wasn't here back then, but from everyone in finance and the financing team, they've always had the greatest things to say about your support, your interests, and I just wanted to thank you for that. Really appreciate it. And I've been here almost 2 years now, and I personally appreciate all of your support and encouragement. So just wanted to say thank you.
Well, I thank you for the kind words, Thomas. And I also wanted to say again that your analysis that you provided for the economic value of the CFD program, you know, I thought was outstanding. And there are some people looking to try and do this in other districts and other counties. Everything that you have done, and Laura, is probably going to be a milestone for some other folks to help their districts out. I thank you very, very much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right, let's go to agenda item 5D, which is approve and authorize West San Jacinto Groundwater Sustainability Agency monitoring program for calendar year 2021 and an appropriation of $330,080.
President Sullivan,
yes.
I might point out we are, the presentation we're going to give covers both item D and item E.
Okay.
As you noted, item D is for the West San Jacinto Groundwater Sustainability Agency, our responsibilities under that program for monitoring. Item E is also for monitoring, but it is for the Hemet San Jacinto Water Master in our work that we do to support the Water Master. So we will take those items together with your permission.
Terrific.
Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. Today I'll present to you the groundwater monitoring programs for calendar year 2021. So today the items that will be covered include the locations of the programs, the components of the groundwater monitoring programs, the estimated budgets for 2021, and our recommendation. So the figure that you see here is the San Jacinto groundwater basin in its entirety. The western portion of the basin is referred to the West San Jacinto Groundwater Sustainability Agency plan area, also referred to as the West San Jacinto Basin. And then the eastern portion of the basin is adjudicated, and it's referred to the Hemet-San Jacinto Groundwater Management Plan area. The west side of the basin, as Paul mentioned, Eastern became the Groundwater Sustainability Agency in 2017, and we are responsible for monitoring and reporting requirements in this area. And on the east side, the Hemet-San Jacinto Water Master is responsible for the monitoring and reporting. So the components of the program include collecting annual groundwater quality samples, semi-annual groundwater level samples, and we do a spring and fall event so we can assess the seasonal variability of groundwater elevations in our basin to support all the programs, as well as monthly extraction monitoring, and then compiling precipitation, imported water supplies, and recycled water deliveries in the basin in its entirety. Another program that I'll talk about in the next slide is the Paris II Reverse Osmosis Treatment Facility Monitoring and Reporting Plan. That's located on the western portion of the basin or in our GSA area. And then services rendered to both programs as a benefit to our participants include inactive well capping and sealing, new meter installation so we can read the meters so we can have a good handle on the groundwater extraction in our basin and then meter repair, and then also reporting annual extractions to the State Water Resources Control Board as part of our groundwater recordation program. Sorry, it's a lot of words, but bear with me. So the Paris II ROTF Monitoring Reporting Plan was developed as a grant requirement for this program, and it outlines our performance monitoring for the next 20 years of the program. And we implemented the plan in 2020. We're actually undergoing our first baseline sampling event. And so this program addresses constituents of concern in the Paris South and Lakeview groundwater management zones. It includes constituents TDS, nitrate, perchlorate, and PFAS. And we refer to it as a brackish groundwater supply in these areas. So the monitoring includes profiling of open casing wells with our sondes that we purchased, performing depth discrete sampling and collecting composite groundwater samples. And it's all meant to assess the vertical and lateral delineation of our brackish groundwater plume in these areas. So our budgets for both programs, for the western portion of the basin, all the components are outlined. And we're asking for $330,080. I'd like to say that this also includes the preparation of an annual report. It's our first annual report as the GSA that will be submitted to the Department of Water Resources in 2022. And so we're having the same consultant who is preparing our GSP prepare our annual report as well, and that's DUDEC. On the east side, we're asking for $191,715. And please note that Eastern is contracted by the Water Master to perform all the monitoring and prepare the annual report. So our recommendation is for continuation of the groundwater monitoring program in the West San Jacinto Groundwater Sustainability Agency plan area, an appropriation of $330,080 to fund project costs for 2021. Also, execution by the general manager or his designee, a contract with DUDEC to prepare the first annual groundwater monitoring report for the West San Jacinto Groundwater Sustainability Agency in an amount not to exceed $50,000, and then the continuation of the monitoring program in the Hemet-San Jacinto Water Management Area, an appropriation of $191,715. And please note that this cost will be reimbursed by the Hemet-San Jacinto Water Master. Any questions?
President Sullivan, if I can also add that cost that Rachel mentioned, the $191,000, was presented and reviewed at the Water Master Technical Advisory Committee and was agreed upon by all the participants.
Terrific.
Okay. So, Director Sullivan, we have these listed as two items.
Sure. So I would suggest you take them as two votes, please.
Please. Sure.
I'll move items D and E on the action calendar.
Second.
Seconded by Director Record for 5D and E. I have a roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Polly?
Aye.
Director Slosson?
Aye.
Director Record? Director Record?
Aye.
Director Corona?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Thank you, Rachel.
And a happy Thanksgiving to you.
Thank you. You as well. Go to agenda item 6, which is the overview of customer data, financial impacts related to the coronavirus. Charles, we'll see how close we come to 10 o'clock after this presentation. And we may take a pause, but after this presentation, we'll probably want to take a sugar break.
Okay. That works. I'll stay for the break. How about
okay.
that? good morning, President Sullivan and members of the board. Thank you for this opportunity for Laura and I to provide an update on this item. So we'll go ahead and get started, and I hope folks on the phone can hear me. So by way of background, Senate Bill 998 went into effect in February of this year, and the main provision of SB 998 is no non-payment shutoff until a customer has been delinquent for 60 days. Soon after that, as you may remember, the California governor signed an executive order in April of this year related to COVID-19, and the order basically restricted shutoffs while the state continues to respond to the ongoing pandemic. It's also important to note that in the order, it was very clear that it does not eliminate the customer's obligation to pay for the water that they consume. And so both of these items have had an impact on our payments and delinquencies, and Laura and I will be sharing those with you this morning. So the areas impacted, so we looked at how many customers are going delinquent this year compared to last year, and then we'll share some of that data with you in the coming slides. We're also seeing an increase in account aging. Now, aging is unpaid customer bills that extend beyond 61 days. We have some data to share with you there. And it's also important to remind the board that, we've instructed customer service staff to continue to assist our customers through these trying times. And the way we're doing that is by late fee adjustments or waiving late fees and also offering up the recently launched Help to Others program, which launches September. And I have some data to share with you in the coming slides. The program is really going well. So looking at delinquent customers, the graph that you're looking at here represents the percent of customers that have gone past due this year compared to last. And so what we're seeing is there's a monthly average increase of about 7,500 more customers going delinquent this year compared to last since Senate Bill 998 went into effect, as I mentioned, in February of this year. However, what's really interesting when we look at the data is the historically delinquent customers, they're the ones that are carrying a larger balance over an extended period of time, which is having a direct impact on account aging. So speaking about account aging, the graph here represents, again, this year compared to last, and you'll see as when we pull the data in October, it was about the third week of October, aging was up to 14.3%, which is about a 10% increase since, again, Senate Bill 998 went into effect in February of this year. Now, by way of comparison, when we compare this to last year, at the close of last year, aging was at 3.5%. Taking another comparison to the close of the Great Recession, as you all may remember, that was at the tail end of 2009, aging closed at about 14.5%. I'm sorry, 11.4%. And Laura will be expounding on this in the coming slides, so I won't steal her thunder. But that's just a comparison of where we are today compared to where we closed last year compared to the close of the year of the Great Recession, the tail end of the Great Recession. So what are we doing to help our customers? You know, as I mentioned, you know, there's a couple of different things, you know, that we've been instructing staff to do. One of those things is processing payment arrangements. And basically a payment arrangement is taking the customer balance, breaking out into smaller payments over time. And so we'll continue to do that, and we continue to do that. And what we're seeing is that there's longer repayment plans that are increasing the amount that's been amortized. And it's also important to note that as part of this process of setting up payment arrangements, we do waive late fees that a customer may have been assessed. So that's part of that process. And so when we look at September, again, when I pulled the data, there was just a little over 6,100 payment arrangements that had been processed. And the dollar amount is $404,000 compared to last year was $308,000. So the difference is about $96,000 more this year compared to last. So we're definitely continuing to help our customers. And as I mentioned, we're seeing those dollars increase and increase over time. And then lastly on here, you know, I mentioned the Help to Others program that the board approved in September of this year. So again, when we prepared this, it was 21 customers had received a credit adjustment on their account. 2 weeks ago during the admin committee, that number had gone up to 54. And when I looked at it this morning before I drove over here, it was up to 82. So, you know, customers are continuing to receive this assistance. And, you know, we're working with Jolene and April with the PGA group to start to market this out to our community. So over the next week or so, we'll be sending out letters and mailers. There'll probably be a notice on the website as well. So with that, before I pass it on to Laura, I'd be open to answer any questions.
Yeah, I have a couple questions. One, so the reason the Help to Others H2O increased exponentially just the last couple of weeks, is that because it just rolled out and customers aren't aware of it yet? And that's why you're going to do the additional marketing.
That's a good observation, yeah. So it was a soft launch is what we called it that we did. So we didn't market it. We didn't put anything on our website. So really the way customers were learning from it is if they called the customer service department. So the more customers did that and the word got out, we're seeing those numbers go up. But as I mentioned, you know, I think in a week or so we'll be sending out customer notification to all our customers. So this word will get out to our customers as well.
I expect there's some word of mouth too within the community.
Yep.
As people are being helped.
Yep.
Yeah, and just to expand on that, we did the soft launch to make sure the program administratively was set up correctly with United Way.
Yeah.
We did have these customers come in, as Charles points out, they're kind of, you know, doubling every day. We're having a little bit of an increase in it. But as Charles also mentioned, we are going to do a targeted outreach communication to the 61-plus day aging customers where they're not just getting a bill. It's going to be a direct communication to those customers. We're going to let them know about the Help to Others program, also let them know about our payment plan options. So we're going to do a focused communication just on those customers, and that's kind of our next step. And then in companion with that will be kind of the hard launch or the more public launch of the Help to Others program where we're going to be using our social media channels, our website, and get that information out in the community. So we fully expect that we'll see the participation in the Help to Others program go up very, very quickly as a result of those more direct efforts with the customers.
So the soft launch was intentional because it was going to be like a working test program.
Right. We put a new program in place. We had a counterparty in United Way. We just wanted to make sure everything was working smoothly. And there were a couple things we needed to work out with them, clarifications, but we have it up and running and in really good shape right now.
Right.
And that was the purpose of doing the soft launch.
Okay. Yep. And then these aging accounts, are they mostly like Moreno Valley? Have a high percentage compared to the rest?
Yeah, it's interesting you bring that up. So I've been looking at data and sharing it with Jolene and others. So you may recall the customer segmentation effort that we did a few years back, and it identified the various customer personas that we had. So I looked at the data, and you're right, it is heavily in a Moreno Valley area, Paris area. We're seeing a lot of delinquencies in that area, and I think in the Hemet area as well. So those are the areas that we're finding are carrying a lot of the aging balance is coming from that area.
Okay.
Yep.
That's all I have. Great presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Hey, Laura.
Laura. A little shorter. Good morning, President Sullivan and members of the board. So in the last two updates we provided to the board, we have been able to provide context on how the district has been faring through COVID-19. Last May, we did build a financial model that would assist in us projecting possible economic and financial scenarios and outcomes. We provided two scenarios at that time, a forecast impact and a severe impact, to provide the board a range of outcomes. So we outlined critical budget parameters that we needed to keep an eye on, which included our water sales, our property tax receipts, connection fees, operating expenses, and of course our customer payments and collections. The financial model projects the overall fiscal impact to the district, including revenues, expenses, funds available for our capital projects, reserves, and fiscal metrics such as our debt service coverage and our days cash on hand. This model was also utilized to help us project adjustments for our budget, our current budget, for 2020-21 that the board approved this past June. Those are numbers that are included in the green column. The blue column is our best estimate of where we believe this fiscal year will end using year-to-date numbers and the remaining year-end estimates using current trends. The yellow column was the severe projection that we provided last May and July to provide context of what we thought was worst-case scenario. And then we also included the gray column, which was the recession high, just to give you context. So our 2021 assumptions, which is the blue column, show that our water sales are tracking at 1% less than budget based on current trends. So not too far off. We don't feel like COVID is really affecting our water sales. We anticipate property taxes to come in as planned. Our connection fee revenue, if you recall, we lowered a bit when we did our budget estimates for the second year of our two-year budget. And we are coming in better than planned by about 3.2%. And our operating expenses are trending lower than budget by about 1.5%. We're spending a lot less on many of our expenses, including travel. Our public government affairs obviously can't get out and really do the programs that they've been doing, so we do have some savings there. Now, we are concerned about two areas, and Charles did highlight the first one, which is our aging, and our aging is really running severe. I mean, it's really at recession highs, and as he mentioned, that's mainly due to the shutoff order. We do have customers on payment plans, as he suggested, but we also have many customers that have made no payments since March or April. The second area of concern is our write-offs. This number is tracking low, so you can see we've only have about 400 that we're projecting for this year. And that's because we can't start a collection process with the current governor's order. Normally what would happen is if somebody doesn't pay, we'll start our door hanger process and our whole collection process, which leads to write-offs. There is no date certain of when this shutoff will be lifted. So for the current fiscal year, we're not anticipating to write off accounts. I anticipate when we bring the two-year budget next spring, we'll probably have to deal with that number at that time. But we'll be keeping an ear out for what the governor's plans are, and we'll be coming back to deal with that line item at a later date. But we want to continue, as Charles said, protect the district. So we're talking internally about potentially, you know, taking a more proactive role of leaning properties to safeguard collection, and looking at potential, adding some of the 60 or 120-day accounts over a certain balance to the property tax roll. And also we're looking at the Franchise Tax Board's intercept program, which means we would do something similar where we apply balances to their income tax. So we're looking at all those different options, and we'll probably be coming back with a report to the board regarding those programs. So that was one slide. So I wanted to stop there. The rest of them aren't going to take that long, but does anyone have any questions on the assumptions or these discussions?
If we were to implement either property liens or property tax rolls or working through the Franchise Tax Board program, would we limit it to accounts that were over a certain amount?
I think we would, and I'll leave it to Charles maybe to answer that question, but I think we would look at, you know, extensively late customers, larger balances. I think we would come up with parameters that we would bring to the board for approval, you know, kind of not somebody that just went one day over 60 and has a $25 balance. We obviously would be looking at accounts that really are a little bit more meaningful and late, severely late.
Okay. My thought was that, it may not be worth our, mm-hmm. The cost just going through the process may be prohibitive for the smaller amounts.
Yeah, exactly. And we're in just the exploratory phase on this. And so we would come back with a formal policy recommendation to the board, including the criteria to which we would apply to this.
All right.
All right. So this area of the model takes our projections and our assumptions to calculate the overall fiscal impact to the district. For the financial forecast that we went over on the last slide, we are projecting the fiscal year. Our metrics are continue to be strong. For example, our debt service coverage is projected to end the year at 2.4 times, and our days cash at about 562 days. I wanted to give a little bit of context, so let's just say that the governor does lift the order tomorrow, and we do have to start our collections process. And let's just assume that we do have to write off what we were thinking would be our potential forecast of $1 million. So we reran the model as making those assumptions. And I just wanted to assure the board that our we don't want to write off $1 million, but let's just say we had to. It really doesn't affect our debt service coverage tremendously. It's about a tenth of a percent to our debt service, one tenth of a point. And on our day's cash, it's about one day. So while we're not looking to try and write off any accounts, I did just want to assure you that even if we did have, that would be the impact. So this area, so now we're going to move on to a few slides that just highlight the critical financial parameters we are monitoring. This first one is our accounts receivable write-off, and Charles really got into this in depth, but it's influenced many times without COVID with just seasonality, local economy, and drought. But now with COVID, obviously, it's spiked, and we're dealing with the over 60 balances. The green line kind of shows where we're at today, and the orange line where you look in the COVID box is where severe, if we it's a couple points. We're not that far off from the severe plan. Our write-offs we have discussed in depth. It's something that we are way under budget on only because of the shutoff order. We are trying to facilitate not having to write off as much by signing our customers up on payment plans and having them get into a method of payment, even if it takes a little longer. Oh, what happened? Okay, connection fees. Again, our connection fees are coming in a little bit better than budget. Housing development, and as you can see with Thomas bringing up the CFD issuance of bonds, is still moving forward with single-family housing in general. So we anticipate this number to be above budget. So in summary, our aging obviously is more than we would like it to be, mainly due to the governor's shutoff order. Our customer service staff continue to assist our customers with payment options and obviously our new low-income assistance program. The financial model shows us being in a strong financial position, and we're prepared to weather these uncertain times. Our projections are mostly favorable to the 2021 budget update, and we are not anticipating severe impact levels, except for in the aging area. And our metrics show that we can and will maintain our AA plus AAA rating. Our next steps will be that we'll bring another update to you in January to let you know where things are. And with that, that ends our formal presentation, and Charles and I are available for any questions.
Okay. Directors, have any questions?
I had a comment. Well, I understand that this situation does not materially impact the overall financial picture of the district. I still want to make sure we take it seriously. I don't want to get into a culture here where it's okay not to pay your water bill. That you know, if everybody chose not to pay your water bill, it would have a very severe impact on what we do here. And it just concerns me that we maybe societally are starting to say it's okay not to pay our bills. And I don't want that to be part of the culture here. I love the fact that we're doing rate assistance programs. I love the fact that we have this new program in place, Charles, that you seem to be implementing very, very well with our partnership with the United Way. But I want to keep the mantra here that we pay our water bills.
Yes, and I think the letter that will be going out probably within the next week will kind of communicate that to our customers. While we're sympathetic to what's going on with COVID-19, you know, the bill is still due, but we have methods to help them either through payment plans or customer assistance. So I think we're hoping that really kind of stimulates the conversation.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess the other, just to follow up with Director Pauly's question, is if we write something off and somebody comes back in that we wrote off and they want to hook up again, are we going to require a deposit?
Yeah, so I think the question that you asked was, if a customer is written off and they come back and want to establish service again with the district, yes, we do require that they pay a deposit in addition to satisfying what was written off.
Terrific.
Yeah.
Okay.
And if I can address Director...
Yeah, President Sullivan,
Yes, Director Record.
I agree with Director Pauly, and we need to really... take any step necessary to make sure that even in spite of what the governor says and this human right to water, somebody's got to pay for what we do. I would suggest that when the letter that does the outreach, you might also include that we've been very aggressive in our rate structure to make sure that the people that can least afford it have the cheapest rate and they are available. They can't get water that is necessary. So I'd like to include that in the letter.
Just to clarify, Director Record, kind of the notion that our rate structure is set up such that if you do have the ability to substantially reduce your expenses through controlling your water use. Is that what I heard you say?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Thank you.
I wonder if, based on that, what Phil said, Director Pauly said, and Randy as well. I wonder if we were further along in deciding what route to take in terms of liens or property tax rolls or franchise tax board, could we actually include that in a letter? Say that ultimately you're going to be responsible and we have the right to do one of these things, or is that premature?
My preference would be to wait on that. Okay. We want to kind of put out the olive branch first and really kind of encourage them to make their payment. I think we'll have plenty of opportunity to kind of maybe lay down the hammer a little bit later.
Okay.
Well, and I agree with that. That would be my recommendation as well. But I do think the language needs to be very strong and emphasize the portion of the governor's executive order that seems to be overlooked, that ultimately customers are responsible for the payment of the bills.
Yeah.
And we will emphasize that very heavily. To your point, Director Pauly, I think you said that this isn't material. It is material. It's a lot of money. It's a very significant amount. And ultimately, if you think about it, we have to pursue this because the potential impact is on our other customers who would have to be picking up those expenses. Mm-hmm. So we realize that and we're taking it very seriously. Again, I think what we're seeing, though, in the media and the messaging from the governor is certainly not helpful. But we will take this, in stride, and we will do these more aggressive communications and more direct communications with customers, see if we can bring more people into getting caught up on their payments and then continue to adjust as necessary. But I do want to, you know, let the board know that we do take this very seriously and it concerns us.
The other thing, I'll just make another statement that concerns me too, is from Sacramento, we have the governor saying, okay, it's basically okay if you can't pay your bill or having a hard time, don't pay your bill. Then another department in Sacramento says, let's make sure we conserve water. Well, I believe conserving water and paying your bill go hand in hand. I mean, if we're going to let people slide on their bills, what incentive is there to use your water efficiently and correctly? So I get this mixed message from Sacramento on this, too, that I think I don't know how to address it. I'm just saying it seems odd to me that we have this dichotomy of messages coming from.
Right, and I think we're going to message around that per director record suggestion where we say you can control your water use and and substantially control your future expenses for water. Mm-hmm. So we will reinforce that. I think that's a really good idea.
Well, I think another thing to keep in our back pocket is the fact that we have meters now. We've been installing meters, and I think Charles can, that have the trickle feature on it. I mean, we get to the point of where we want to turn that on, we've looked at other agencies' admin codes to see how you would approach putting something in the admin code that highlights the ability to do that. And so that's another feature that I think we have tooled in the future to utilize as well to accommodate the issue of overuse.
Yep. Charles, do we have how many? Remind me where we are in the process right now of that our low flow meter.
Yeah, so we have about 220 meters in the ground.
Okay.
And following the last board update that we provided, I believe in October, we put in an order for another 580, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
And those would be deployed to the most severe Frequent. Accounts, let's just call them.
Yep. Excellent.
All right. Thank you.
Any other questions on this, Director Sullivan?
No. How are we doing with George Johnson chimed in yet?
He would be in 2 minutes.
We'll just be patient for a couple of minutes.
And if he's late, he won't get his proclamation.
I don't want to start off on the next one because
yes,
I don't want to
interrupt
anybody.
Yes, it's a pretty substantial item. Perhaps if Mr. Johnson comes on, we could do his proclamation, and then if you would like to do a break, that might be a logical break.
Yeah, I'd like to do that.
Okay, thank you.
But I think that last report shows, you know, how financially well off this district is. You know, no matter what the governor says, what we have to do, and the people don't pay their bills. This is, you know, the financial position that this district is in is, I think, absolutely outstanding. One of the reasons that we have a AAA or AA plus ratings with all the agencies goes to the financial stability that this district has, and a lot of that goes to the finance staff and the general manager and the executive staff.
Not agree more.
So is George going to text you as to when he's going to be on the call?
This is George. I just joined the call right now.
Excellent.
All right.
Perfect
Welcome.
Timing. Hi, Rod.
Hi, George.
Well, thank you for inviting me. How are you?
It's our honor and pleasure.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to hear your voice.
Great. Thank you. President Sullivan, members of the board, I'm pleased to present this proclamation to George Johnson. And, George, welcome. Thank you for attending the board meeting today. This is in honor of your career and service as Riverside County Executive Officer. So I'm going to go ahead and read the proclamation. In May 2017, George Johnson was appointed as the Riverside County Executive Officer, acting as an agent to the Board of Supervisors to ensure effective and efficient delivery of programs and services across Riverside County in over 42 departments and 22,000 employees. And whereas George has had a long and distinguished career as a public servant, starting out his career in 1991 as a civil engineer in the Transportation Department, where later Mr. Johnson became the county's Director of Transportation. And whereas preceding his appointment as a Riverside County Executive Officer, Mr. Johnson served as Chief Assistant CEO, which functioned as the Chief Operating Officer for Riverside County, where he worked collaboratively with the Board of Supervisors, the CEO, and the various Riverside County departments to assist Riverside County's financial recovery from the Great Recession. Whereas George has repeatedly demonstrated his dedication to the pursuit of service for the betterment of Riverside County, its many residents and businesses, including Eastern Municipal Water District and its customers. And whereas EMWD would like to acknowledge Mr. Johnson for his support and contributions to the development of key water and sewer infrastructure projects, such as the Wine Country Infrastructure Project and the Quail Valley Septic to Sewer Conversion Project, both efforts of which have been critical to the residents and businesses of those areas. And we'd like to acknowledge George for his many contributions to Riverside County, his dedicated leadership, and his service to the region. So I'd also like to say when I started with Eastern, I was new to the area. One of the first significant items we addressed was the Wine Country Sewer Project. George was very involved in that from the county standpoint. And really welcomed me and brought me into the fold and really supported Eastern in very many ways. And I always appreciated that. And George has been just a great friend to Eastern Municipal Water District. So, George, thank you very much personally from me and on behalf of the district. Thank you. And when we see you sometime, we will get this proclamation to you. But, again, we just want to express our appreciation and congratulations in your retirement. And so I turn it back over to you, President Sullivan, or George, if he'd like to say a few words.
Yeah, George, you'd like to, because I have a few words I'm going to share, but I'd like to hear from George.
Well, thank you so much to Chairman Sullivan and to Paul. We've had a long career together, and it really has been a tremendous honor to work closely with EMD. Throughout my career here in the county, you've been a tremendous partner, and I think we've done amazing work together to improve the quality of life, provide much-needed infrastructure to some key areas. You know, Paul, when you came on board with the EMWD, we were struggling through the Wine Country Sewer Project, but thanks to your leadership, we were able to put that together, and that's made a tremendous impact to the Wine Country, and then you also mentioned the Quail Valley Sewer Project. That was incredibly beneficial for that community that had suffered for many, many years for having some water quality challenges and lack of sewer in that area. So, and there's many, many others. And Ron, you and I go back to working on the Dominigoni Parkway Project and providing the much-needed infrastructure so that area could grow and develop over time. So it's been a tremendous privilege for me to work closely with all of you, and I wish you all the best. I know I have just tremendous respect and admiration for each and every one of you, so this honor and recognition means a lot to me, so thank you.
Thank you, George. I just want to put in my two words that I've really known you since about 1991, 1992, when I was doing a little bit of consulting, and you were one of the class acts to work with in the county because you were always willing to sit down and work through an issue. And that just shows how well you were able to go from an engineer in the transportation department to the CEO. It just tells how well you are able to work with people. And to see each issue through and just remain, as I would always say, you are a public servant that is absolutely a class act. and it's been my pleasure to know you through these years, and I hope sometime in the future I get a chance to see you someplace out in the area. Any other directors like to have a comment?
Yeah, President Sullivan, George Randy Record here. Thank you for your service, and congratulations on your retirement. It's been a pleasure working with you.
All right. George, thank you for joining us today, and this proclamation, we'll be sure to get that to you before you leave the offices on the fourth floor. And we wish you the best in retirement, and I'm sure that you will be around here for a while to help guide this county.
Well, again, thank you for inviting me to be part of this today and for the recognition, and I do hope we can see each other in person sometime soon. I look forward to that. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And the best of luck in retirement.
Right.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. With that, let's take about a 10-minute break, and then we'll continue on. We'll wait for Jolene to show up here. And with that, we'll reconvene the director's meeting, and we'll go to agenda item 6B, which is the 2020 annual legislative report by Jolene and Danielle.
Thanks, President Sullivan, members of the board. We do have the presentation on this. Also have a written copy of our annual legislative report that's been provided. And, of course, we have Jolene Walsh and Danielle Coates, our federal and state advocacy A-team, to give us the report. And Jolene's going to go ahead and start off.
And it's live and not virtual.
Yay. President Sullivan, Vice President Pauley, and members of the board, it is a true pleasure to be here before you today to present the annual legislative report with Danielle. As Paul mentioned, you should each have a hard copy in front of you. Director, very nice. Director Record and Corona, there is a copy linked online, and we have hard copies in the mail on the way to you. So just a brief overview of our presentation. I'm going to provide the federal highlights from 2020 and then hand it over to Danielle for the legislative action team overview and the 2020 state legislative highlights. So to start with the federal highlights, we'll do a quick recap of the 116th Congress, kind of outline some expectations for the lame duck session, and as well as some early expectations for the 117th Congress. Just start with a little snapshot of the 116th Congress by the numbers. Just under 16,000 bills were introduced. 196 bills have been enacted thus far. The session isn't over yet. We anticipate a few more will be enacted, and then we reviewed about 130 of those and took positions on about 130 of those. So a quick recap of the 116th on the administrative efforts side. About half of the 116th was definitely punctuated by pandemic management. And our last advocacy trip to Washington, D.C., we were actually leaving as they were shutting down the Hill, and we were already doing the elbow bump greeting. So that was we were there for the transition. But the 116th also saw the repeal of the Obama-era Waters of the U.S. rule, which was very problematic for EMWD, especially as it related to the management of our recycled water and recharge ponds that were adjacent to the San Jacinto River and Salt Creek. So that was a very positive thing that happened in the 116th. We also saw a really significant advancement of water recycling. The administration advanced a water reuse action plan.
His Muzak is on.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's in the elevator.
But this administration advanced water recycling more than any administration that we've ever seen. They developed the Water Reuse Action Plan that was led by EPA, but it was orchestrated by all of the federal agencies that have any role in water. And as Paul was closing out his term as president of the National Water Reuse Association earlier this year, he was part of the team in Washington, D.C. that rolled out the final national action plan. This gave recycled water incredible visibility that it had never had before on a national level. We also welcomed in new commanders to the LA office, the South Pacific Division, and headquarters of the Army Corps of Engineers. We go out of our way to have a really excellent relationship with all levels of the Army Corps. So we did welcome in all the new commanders. And then just at the beginning of last month, an executive order was issued on modernizing America's water resources and water infrastructure. That was also a multi-agency effort, kind of coordinating all the federal agencies that have a role in water management. On to Eastern's priorities, more on the legislative front. One of our top priorities, of course, is our Army Corps funding for the Paris II desalter. We've received $20.3 million to date, and we are pursuing the outstanding balance of $4.7 million in this year's work plan, and that will close that out. In addition, we have aggressively pursued our $25 million authorization modification that would double that original authorization to $50 million. And as we've reported previously, that language to effectuate that was included in both the House and the Senate Water Resources Development Act legislation. We also are really strong advocates for increasing the funding for the Environmental Infrastructure Funding Pot. When we started doing this a few years ago nationwide, there was only about $20 million in that funding category, and now it's up to about $100 million annually. But the larger the funding pot is for the nation, the better we fare in terms of our annual funding through the Army Corps work plan. We've been active advocates for wind Title 16 funding, which is a grant component for recycled water funding through the Bureau of Reclamation. Unfortunately, that program expires in FY21, so we've been actively seeking reauthorization for that. The demand for that program exceeds about $650 million nationwide, so it's an important program to keep alive. We also supported Senator Feinstein's legislation, S-83811, to restore conveyance in California. This would provide funding to restore and rehabilitate projects like the State Water Project and other aqueducts in California that have lost conveyance due to subsidence. And we also awarded Senator Feinstein EMWD's Water Leader at the very beginning of this year for all of her work both on recycled water as well as other Western water issues. Continuing with our priorities from this year on the EPA front, of course, we're actively advocating for increased funding in both the Clean and Drinking Water State Revolving Loaned Funds. And we've also been advocating for a new funding category, Alternative Water Source Pilot Program, which would be a nationwide program to fund recycled water. Right now, Title 16 just funds recycled water in the Bureau of Reclamation states, but that program would make recycled water funding available to the whole nation. We also got tipped off to a new sewer overflow stormwater reuse grant program that we had our eye on for Quail Valley. We had very successful meetings with EPA, and we coordinated with the regional board to make sure when those dollars are released that Quail Valley would be eligible. There were this year in the House Appropriations Bill, there were $56.7 million allocated, which is $30 million more than the previous year. So we do want to continue to see those funding for that category continue to increase. And then while we were not particularly active on the COVID relief legislation, we did support the Special Districts Provide Essential Services Act, which would provide special districts access to coronavirus relief funding. And then we did support funding to aid delinquent customers. We continued to advance the North Paris Groundwater Contamination Remediation Program efforts, reminding our legislators how important that was. And we also had a meeting early in the year with the staff from the Pentagon to advance that. PFAS advocacy, this year we opposed rushing the science on setting the PFAS MCL, and we also opposed making PFAS a CERCLA-regulated chemical. And EPA continues to move on their PFAS action plan, which we have been supporting, continuing the good science that they're doing. Really quickly, the expectations for the lame duck. I think Paul pointed out the most important item for us, which is seeing the Water Resources Development Act through to enactment, including Eastern's language. At this point, the federal government is only funded through December 10th with that continuing resolution, so we do want to see the FY21 appropriations enacted or another continuing resolution to carry us through the next year. COVID legislation is also on tap for the lame duck session. The House, Senate, and the White House all agree we need additional legislation, but they're very far apart in the numbers and what they want to see out of that. And then the last item that's up for consideration is a National Defense Authorization Act that has been passed every year for the past 60 years, much earlier in the session in all previous years except this one, so that is outstanding, and we anticipate that will be passed. We have our eye on that because of the PFAS provisions that have been in the past few NDAA bills. We understand that this won't be taken up until after the Senate seats in Georgia are resolved, because there is language in the NDAA directing the renaming of military installations that were named after Confederate soldiers. So that's kind of on pause until early January. Oh, and then expectations for 2021. It's still a very divided landscape, but assuming the GSA certifies the election in Biden's favor, which is still a question mark, I think, if that occurs, we will be getting a new senator. Everything we're hearing on that front is that Newsom has diversity in mind as well as a female. That position has been held by a woman senator for decades, so he intends to continue that according to what we're hearing. And then, of course, we'll be building relationships with our new members of Congress and new administration officials. We'll be looking for new advocates for key issues. A couple members who were really strong advocates for recycled water, Cory Gardner of Colorado and McSally from Arizona, were two of our lead advocates for recycled water. They're gone, so we'll be looking for new advocates for things like that. Of course, COVID recovery, that will still be on the slate for 2021. And then everything we're hearing is the incoming administration has a very serious focus on climate change. If you look at the transition teams, their EPA transition team is led by somebody who has led Earth Justice, an entity that has been very litigious with the past administration. On PFAS, we expect a lot of change on that front. Water affordability, Harris kind of ran on a platform of environmental justice, so we do anticipate water affordability to be a big topic. And then repealing the WOTUS rule that finally got to a good place for us is top of the list for the next administration. And then depending on what happens with those two seats in Georgia, the administration may or may not have access to the Congressional Review Act, which would just give them latitude to repeal more of what occurred in the last administration. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Danielle for the state.
Pause there if there's any questions on the federal issues or federal update.
I just had a quick comment. I'd like to, first of all, in the last several years, yourself, Paul, and Director Sullivan, I think, have served this district very well in our federal affairs, and the trips you make to D.C. or pre-COVID trips you would make to D.C. And so I just want to thank the three of you for doing a fantastic job for this district, bringing money back to the table, making sure our policy positions are always in place. And it is not easy to take trips to the East Coast and sometimes for one or two meetings. And so the sacrifice you make, and especially thank Director Sullivan, who's led this board on that, I can't say enough for the good work we've done in the federal arena. So thank you.
Thank you, Director Paul.
Thank you, Director.
Thank you. And I definitely echo that. We wouldn't have the successful program that we do without Paul's enthusiasm and support, and Director Sullivan's endless energy for federal affairs and building all the right relationships, both in Congress and throughout the arid West. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
All right.
Okay, Danielle, state.
Okay, on to the state. So this is actually my favorite presentation. I know it's actually our longest presentation to make, but it's my favorite for two reasons. First of all, because we get to really showcase the work that we do for the prior year to the board. We don't really deliver projects or infrastructure, so it's a great opportunity to provide what beneficial changes or efforts we've been working on behalf of the district. So, 2018 legislative action team. So the other reason I really like this presentation is because it's a really, really good opportunity to thank the other folks that aren't necessarily in the core legislative group, but do provide a tremendous amount of input and direction to our group in terms of how we communicate to the legislature, to other stakeholders, and to our association. So I really, really want to pause and thank our legislative action team. And then we also tap on multiple experts throughout the district to share their knowledge and wisdom with us. I would be remiss if I really didn't thank Rhonda Cooper for her hard work in bringing together the legislative action team, which did continue to meet throughout the pandemic. And then also Joyce Messon for the good work she does on putting together our legislative annual report. So this just really identifies how we integrate the legislative action team into our process. We do acquire bills, we farm them out, we have conversations, we consult our policy principles and our guiding documents, we consult the general manager and provide letters of support and opposition for his signature. We work with our lobbyists and our associations and really conduct advocacy and outreach process, and then we do it all over again and repeat the process. So I want to switch over to digging into our state session highlights. This does start on page 43 of your annual legislative report. Prior to sort of digging into the numbers, I want to take a moment to take us back to last January when California was in a drastically different place than where we find ourselves today. The coffers of the state budget were flush. We had a $222 billion state budget. We had a $21 billion reserve and a $6 billion rainy day fund. Things were looking very sunny for the state of California. The governor had prioritized homelessness and climate change, affordable housing as priorities for his administration, things that he had on tap to really dig into this year. And he really had a legislature that was willing to help him move forward with these lofty goals. There were a record amount of bills that were introduced this year. We had 2,000 or so rollover from last year, another 3,000 introduced in 2020. District staff and our lobbying team were geared up to really start tackling this mountain of bills that were coming our way. Yet the first week of March, we all know that California started to experience infections, and we experienced our first unfortunate passage in Placer County due to a confirmed case of COVID-19. And as a result, the governor declared a state of emergency, and then on March 19th, he further declared a stay-at-home order. The legislature, in solidarity with the stay-at-home order, did elect to move up the date of their spring recess and also eventually ended up pushing back the date of their return, the first of which would occur multiple times over the legislative session. So I raise these items for two reasons, the first of which is to demonstrate that on March 17th, Eastern actually had a legislative lobbying day planned, and that was right in the, between the 4th and the 19th of the kind of unknown period of time with the COVID issues. But in true Eastern form, we did elect to host our first virtual legislative day in what has since become a more common practice. At the time, it was a little bit revolutionary. Then I also want to talk about how this recess impacted the legislative session. In any given year, the legislature passes to the governor roughly between 870 to 1,200 bills. This year, the governor signed 428 bills. And of those bills, 372 were chaptered, 56 were vetoed. Eastern provided comments on roughly 123 of those bills, or reviewed 123 of those bills, provide correspondence in the volume of 363 letters. And, of course, we had our sponsored bill that we actively pursued this past year, the Small System Water Authority Act by Senator Caballero. I put the numbers for 2019 so you can see sort of the comparison in the volume of what the governor considered. So in the absence of the legislature, we all know that the governor essentially stepped in and started issuing executive orders. He issued between March and to date over 50 executive orders. The executive orders touched on everything from the stay-at-home order to allowing for virtual public meetings. There was a moratorium on evictions and, of course, the moratorium on water shutoffs for non-payment. The most recent that impacted our industry was the 30 by 30 land and conservation, a land and ocean conservation executive order, which will look to have California conserve 30% of its land and its ocean by 30-30. Of course, the governor's executive orders have been legally challenged in court by two members of the assembly, assembly member James Gallagher and Kevin Kiley. The governor did lose that court case because he exceeded his executive authority by reaching into the realm of policymaking by way of executive orders. We'll see what's on tap for any future challenges on that front. So I'm going to cover a significant volume of bills, but I really am going to cherry pick some of the ones that are more of the highlights of throughout the session. So there were a significant number, of course, of COVID-19 related bills that touched on various issues. So some of the bills that really impacted the public realm and actually the way work is conducted in the state was the workers' compensation bill. So there were two bills, AB 196 by Assemblymember Gonzalez and SB 1159 by Assemblymember Hill or by Senator Hill. So the associations in the water industry essentially coalesced around SB 1159, which was ultimately signed into law. The reason being because Senator Hill was far more willing to hear and speak to those that had concerns on the issue, and it also include the ability for people to or entities to demonstrate that the COVID infections did not really occur or did incur at their place of business. So another bill that was curious that was introduced was AB 2095 by Assemblymember Cooper, and it looked at allowing water providers to charge residents different rates for water. The bill was not terribly detailed, and it never received a hearing, but he did raise the idea to bypass Proposition 218 and let ratepayers sort of identify those that are struggling to pay their water bills and charge them a different rate. One of the most significant bills that touched on COVID was AB 685 by Assemblymember Reyes, and this provided a notification procedure if there is infection within a business. Well, clearly a well-intended bill designed to provide notification to other employees throughout the business, and then further provides notification procedures to state agencies and local agencies on where the infections are occurring. The bill lacks significant detail, and it also established a process where there could be a misdemeanor if a an agency failed to do the notification procedures and there was a possibility that they could have known that there was an infection. So that process for the could have known infection was very problematic to the industry, and we were successful in at least getting that part carved out, recognizing that something on this front was going to be passed into law. As far as funding goes, SB 89 was passed in March and established $1 billion in funding for the legislature and the governor to provide for COVID response. This was the first allocation of what was to be multiple efforts to provide funding to alleviate and provide protections from COVID. So climate change, Governor Newsom and the whole administration have earmarked climate change as sort of one of their priority efforts, climate change and resiliency. So I just want to touch on AB 3030, which was the precursor to the governor's executive order on the 30 by 30 Eastern and Metropolitan Water District. We're really successful in elevating this bill, which had flown under the radar most of the session until about July. To the state agency or state association, so we could really provide some advocacy work, because unlike the governor's executive order, AB 3030 also looked to require water, 30% of water to be conserved. How that worked with existing mandates, it was completely unclear, so much so that Assembly Appropriations Committee raised a series of questions in their analysis and really had a hard time earmarking or tagging a cost estimate for implementation of this bill. So that bill ultimately did fail, and then, as mentioned, it became the precursor to the executive order. As far as funding and bond funding goes, one of the bills did roll over from 2019, but there was significant conversation, clearly as a priority of the administration, to provide a bond for the November 3rd, 2020 ballot on to facilitate climate change, address drought, and address wildfire. So these bond totals range from about $4.75 billion to a little over $6 billion. Eastern, with a local coalition of other water providers, worked extensively to get language in a bond that would facilitate septic to sewer conversion. We did receive sort of a sympathetic ear from Assemblymember Garcia and an unpublished RN. He did carve out funding for septic to sewer conversion. Ultimately, however, the governor did signal that due to the COVID constraints on the state budget, there really wasn't an interest or ability to put a climate change bond on the November ballot. So an effort that we've spent considerable time on over the years is clearly the safe and affordable and reliable drinking water effort. We've had AB 2050 back in 2018, and then for the past 2 years we've been working on SB 414. SB 414 for the last year sat in the Assembly Appropriations Committee. We did work extensively at the direction of committee consultants and committee authors to come to a consensus with stakeholders, including the State Water Resources Control Board and the environmental justice community. We were unsuccessful, though, in passing the bill. However, it has been a tremendous conversation starter and definitely something that has really resonated. This past year, we expanded the bill to include at-risk water systems and look to voluntary as well as mandatory consolidation processes. It really, really stimulated the governance discussion and provide a thorough look at what economies of scale are needed to address failing water systems. So one of the other bills that were that was signed into law is SB 974 by Senator Hurtado. I flagged this bill because earlier versions of our effort, AB 2050, looked to exclude small failing water systems from CEQA if they're trying to develop infrastructure that would address the issue. So ultimately addressing CEQA was carved out of our bill, but it was picked up by the environmental justice community and ultimately signed into law. Similar to the federal effort, PFAS was a big issue this year, as expected. Our partners to the west, Orange County Water District, and our other partner in the legislature, California Municipal Utilities District, were successful in passing AB 2560 by Assemblymember Quirk. This bill pertains to notification and response levels that are set by the State Water Resources Control Board. It establishes a more transparent process that the state board must adhere to when they're establishing NLs or RLs. Eastern was a very strong supporter of this effort, and we are pleased to see that it was passed and ultimately signed into law. A similar effort, SB 996, this bill was sponsored by the Metropolitan Water District and CMUA. This bill ultimately did not move forward because of COVID. I know the two source control on PFAS bills have been brought before the board before as part of the larger PFAS conversations, AB 2762, which would preclude the sale and import of cosmetics containing PFAS, as well as SB 1044, which would not allow for PFAS to be included in firefighting foams. Both of those bills were signed into law, although we are clearly not done with the PFAS issue. Wildfires. This 2020 had the unfortunate distinction of being the largest, of holding the largest number of wildfires to date. And as a result, more than a dozen bills were introduced in the legislature to address either wildfire issues or public safety power shutoffs. Two bills that I want to feature are AB 2182 by Blanca Rubio, which pertains to emergency backup generators, and then SB 1099 by Dodd, which also pertains to emergency backup generators. Those two bills, 2182 was sponsored by Aqua, 1099 by CMUA and Las Virgenes Water District. Neither bill passed out of the legislature, but both generated significant conversation on the issue of runtime and usage during a public safety power shutoff by backup generators. So again, neither bill passed, but SB 1099 did stimulate conversation within the South Coast Air Quality Management District, where it is anticipated that they will start making developing a rulemaking similar to that front. The other bill I just want to touch on this slide is SB 1386 by Senator Morlock. Senator Morlock did a great job with the Irvine Ranch Water District and the San Diego County Water Authority on passing legislation that codified an existing unpublished court case that allowed for water for firefighting and firefighting fixtures such as fire hydrants to be included in as a property expense under Proposition 218. So Eastern was a very strong supporter of that bill, and we did work to advocate in support of that effort, which did get signed. Three more unique bills that I really want to touch on before we move forward are AB 992 by Assemblymember Mullen. So this bill provides clarity on how the Brown Act applies to social media and really answered the question on if the Brown Act applied to social media at all. So it really declares that a legislative body may use social media, but they may not use social media to discuss official business amongst themselves, which is defined as making posts, commenting, or using digital icons that express reactions to communications made by other members of the board of the legislative body. So I just wanted to bring that to the forefront to share that the legislature had weighed in on how to utilize social media under the Brown Act. Of course, on the sewer side, AB 1672 was an effort by CASA that really sought to have labeling done on pre-moistened, non-woven disposable wipes, or as we affectionately know them as flushable wipes, that stated that these should not be flushed. There was a last-minute effort by the industry at the end of session, and that bill was ultimately held in committee. And finally, Metropolitan Water District did seek to have a designation under the Surface Mining and Reclamation Act for their work that they were doing in largely in Riverside and San Bernardino County. Assemblymember Mays and Metropolitan ultimately made the decision to hold the bill due to COVID and may revisit it in the future. So outside of the legislative effort, we did engage substantially on a number of other priority projects by some of our state regulatory bodies. Of course, AB 401, the low-income water rate assistance report, was finally released after a two-year delay back in February, and that report has emerged more to the forefront in conversations as to how we will be moving forward with addressing the shutoff moratorium. The State Board also did pass the historic Safer Expenditure Plan Fund for the 2020-2021 fiscal year, and this was a landmark effort that was developed after multiple outreach efforts with an advisory group. And then, of course, the governor released his 2020 water resilience portfolio earlier in the year, and we'll see how that emerges to define water delivery in California. So what's on tap for 2021? So, of course, COVID recovery. And to the earlier conversation, I just wanted to indicate that we have formed a local advocacy partnership with other agencies in Riverside and San Bernardino counties. We are going to be reaching out to the governor's office as well as the state board and other legislative bodies to ask for an end to the moratorium, to ask for a transition into a process that mirrors or if not is SB 998, look to really define an end date and also help seek what a recovery looks like in terms of helping residents pay back their rates. Of course, the state budget has taken quite a hit as a result of COVID-19. We did see a press release from Senate leadership earlier this week that said, well, the fiscal picture of the state is still bad. It's not as bad as they predicted earlier, so I guess that's good news. Climate change, greenhouse gas emission reductions, that's going to be a huge issue. We're going to have to see how the administration is going to move forward with the zero emissions vehicle mandate, as well as the 30 by 30 mandate. Climate resilience bonds, Senator Laird is one of the newest members in the Senate, and as he has historically passed climate change bonds and water bonds, we could look to him to, again, stimulate some of those conversations. There's been a lot of work done on restructuring the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Fund. There's been a lot of curiosity on how that fund is going to be able to pay for and support the SAFER efforts. Water affordability and water shutoffs, clearly we've had conversations earlier today that indicate that this will be a long-time conversation. SAFER implementation is something we closely monitor and engage on, and fees, fines, and rates. Assemblymember Grayson is very engaged in impact fees and defining and determining how fees and connection fees can be applied. Water quality regulations, by all conversations, PFAS is going to be one of the largest issues moving forward. for the water industry, but the state board is also looking at perchlorate and microplastics and a host of other contaminants and constituents of emergent concern. And then we're going to look to our state associations. They have expressed interest in pursuing some Brown Act reform that would allow the virtual format to be either permanent or utilized in state of emergencies. So that's what's on deck for 2021. And then as far as the Small System Water Authority Act, the state board has expressed interest in having the conversations continue. We're looking to see what that will look like going forward, and we have approached the issue with some members of the LAFCO community. So we'll see how that moves forward. And that concludes my part of the presentation. Happy to answer any question. I apologize if it was a bit lengthy.
It's okay. It's thorough. Do you have any questions of Danielle?
Any questions or comments?
Where your best guess on the Brown Act reforms, where do you think, from what you've heard, where is that going? As far as virtual meetings, the public attending virtually?
There's two camps. There's some camps that want to be able to do it and have the discretion, the flexibility, and the ability to utilize a virtual platform. The other camp is looking to essentially force these more virtual platforms to be utilized in the conversations of public agencies to ensure greater transparency and participation by the public. So I think there's a middle, but I think it's going to be a little while before we get there.
Okay, thank you.
Yep.
Any questions of Danielle? Thank you, Danielle.
Great report. Jolene. Thank you. I was just going to make a comment when you had your whole team up there. That normally when you go to a really nice restaurant and, you know, you got everybody there, that they always, everybody congratulates, the food was great, and they always bring the sous chef out for the last applause. So I know Corey is a latecomer, but he's the sous chef back there, and he does an awesome job. And so I want to make sure that we point him out, too, because he's an enthusiastic employee working with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. With that, let's go to item 6C, which is the EM11 transmission system study update. All right.
Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. I'll be co-presenting.
Can you make sure you speak, Laura,
speak up just
speak
a little
up
bit?
A little bit, Laura.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Can everybody hear me? Perfect. Okay, I'll be co-presenting today with John Ward on the EM11 Water Transmission System Project. I'll be presenting the findings of the current planning study, and John will be discussing the ongoing easement appraisal coordination with Metropolitan Water District. For the agenda, the topics covered include background on the project. We'll be discussing the five primary corridors evaluated for the proposed transmission system. Looking at the pump station site alternatives, presenting the preferred alternatives, discussing the pipeline cost analysis, and then John will be discussing the ongoing coordination with MET as well as present the next steps for the project. The M11 transmission system will be a significant expansion of the district's water supply portfolio to meet future demands. The current planning study evaluated, compared, and provided a recommendation for the preferred alternatives for the transmission system, corridors, pump station location, and phasing of these facilities. The M11 transmission system consists of 10 miles of transmission pipeline, ranging in diameter from 48 to 72 inches, a pump station with a capacity of up to 140 CFS, and a new MET connection also up to 140 CFS. The study also evaluated the use of MET easement corridor, where the San Diego Pipelines 1 and 2 are currently located. The M facilities will be phased in over time, with the first phase expected to be needed by 2030. The first phase will supply approximately 40 CFS to the district from MET's Skinner Water Treatment Plant. This supply will be routed north through the transmission system into the district's Paris Valley South service area. The consultant team evaluated five north-south corridors for the EM11 transmission system through the study area. The study area is bounded by Briggs Road on the west, Washington Avenue on the east, Auld Road on the south, and Simpson Road to the north. All corridors started at the intersection of Auld Road and Washington Street near the Skinner Water Treatment Plant, which is shown on the graphic with a red star, and ended at Simpson Road, which is at the top of the graphic. Corridor 1 is the original master plan alignment. This corridor extends along Washington Street until it connects to State Route 79. It's shown on the graphic with a black line. And as you'll notice at the bottom of the graphic, there's a lot of lines that are on top of each other, the orange, the green, the blue, and the black, but they all start at that location at Auld Road and Washington Street. Corridor 2 is the Porroy Road and Eucalyptus alternative. Corridor 2 is depicted by the blue line. It starts at Washington Street and Auld. It traverses along Washington Street until it hits Abelia Street, and then it goes along Porroy Street until it connects up with Leon Road, which is on the yellow line on the graph. When it intersects with Leon Road, it goes north to Simpson Road. Corridor 3 is very similar to Corridor 2. It also traverses through the interior of the study area. Corridor 3 is the green line. You'll see it traverses similar to Corridor 2. However, it connects up to Leon Road, about in the vicinity of Keller Road, and then again goes along Leon Road north to Simpson Road. Corridor 4 is a Briggs Road alternative, and it's shown on this graphic by the orange line. It's the westernmost corridor evaluated. The Briggs Road corridor begins at Washington Street, goes along Thornton Road to the west, then connects up with Briggs Road up to about Garbani Road. Then it connects back to Leon Road, where it again goes north along Leon Road up to Simpson Road. Corridor 5 are the series of MET alternatives that traverse along the easements for San Diego Pipelines 1 and 2. On the graphic, the Corridor 5 alternatives are shown by the yellow lines. The yellow alignments on this figure make up of various combinations of the Corridor 5 MET alternatives that were evaluated in the study. And the next slide will go into further detail on a couple of the specific MET alignments. These five corridors did, however, generate 17 different alignments. From the 17, alignments were then compared against one another to determine the preferred alternatives. As you can see over the next several slides, there's one preferred alternative that uses the MET easement corridors, and there's one preferred alternative from corridors 1 through 4, or what we have called the non-MET alternatives. So moving on to the MET easement alternatives, this slide shows three of the six MET alternatives that were evaluated in the study. These are the three highest ranked MET alternatives. A couple of comments on the figures. The phasing of each alternative is shown in the blue circle with the number that represents the phase. The text callouts above the phasing number indicate the size of the pipeline and whether it's a new pipeline or it's being relined with one of the existing MET San Diego pipelines. Also, where the callout states a parallel pipeline, this means that a new pipeline would be constructed in the MET easement. Alternative 5D is the preferred MET alternative, so I'm going to walk through this alternative in a bit more detail than the other two. The other two alternatives, 5E and F, are still very viable options and show examples of some of the variations possible using the MET corridor. Alternative 5D provides the district with considerable flexibility by being able to phase this project over time as the need arises. The first phase would begin at the intersection of Auld and Leon Road, which is where the booster station would then be sited. This would take advantage of the near-term supply available in the 96-inch MET Auld Valley Pipeline. San Diego County Water Authority has reduced their use of supply from MET on this pipeline, so the district may be able to use available capacity in the Auld Valley Pipeline in the short term. So phase one would consist of relining either San Diego Pipeline 1 or 2 along Leon Road. The relining diameter would be either 43 or 49 inches, depending on which of the pipelines is relined. And phase one ends where the easement kind of traverses to the northeast. Phase two would then continue the relining of San Diego Pipeline along the cross-country easement to the east side of State Route 79. Phase three would then construct a new 60-inch pipeline along Patterson Road up to Simpson Road. The new pipeline would be outside of Met easements at this location, and phase three we're projecting to be needed by approximately 2040. Phase four would be needed by build-out demands. Phase four would require parallel pipelines to be constructed almost the entire length of the alignment, with the exception of the northernmost section. So phase four consists of a new 72-inch pipeline along Auld Road, a new parallel 60-inch along Leon Road, and a new parallel 40-inch across the cross-country easement up to the 60-inch Patterson Road pipeline. Alternative 5D provides the district with significant phasing opportunities. As you may recall, the potable water reliability study is currently looking at the feasibility of a new water treatment plant located in Marina Valley. A 40 CFS Marina Valley water treatment plant could mean that the M11 transmission system could potentially be reduced by 40 CFS. This 40 CFS reduction to the M11 transmission system could potentially mean that all the phase four infrastructure could be eliminated. When we get to the cost analysis slide, you will see the potential financial benefit of having flexibility in these phasing options, which makes the Met alternatives very attractive. A quick summary of the other two alternatives on this slide, which are 5E and 5F. 5E constructs all new pipelines along the yellow alignment. Phase one consists of pipeline along Auld Road and Leon Road up to the cross-country easement. Phase two would then construct a new pipeline along the cross-country easement, and phase three consists of a new pipeline along Patterson Road. 5F is actually quite similar to 5D, with the exception that this alignment stays on Leon Road, as you can see from the graphic, rather than traverse along the Met cross-country easement. The phasing of 5F is also quite similar to 5D, making it another attractive option. So the preferred alignments, for them, a scoring matrix was developed using the criteria shown on the slide. The criteria was separated into four primary categories shown on the left-hand side of the slide. Of the 17 alignments evaluated, we're presenting nine on this slide. And what we're terming the non-MET preferred alternatives, you can see in the red hatched box here, represented by corridors 1 through 4. The preferred alternative for the non-MET easement alternative is 2A, as you can tell by the scoring criteria. When we look at the MET easements, they're the 5 series, so 5 C, D, E, and F. The preferred alternative for the MET alignment was 5D. And again, you can see the relative scoring amongst the alternatives. So the MET alternatives The MET alternatives provide the district with the most flexibility in terms of phasing and also have the lowest initial cost, which we'll see in the upcoming cost analysis slide. Briefly discuss the pump station configurations. With this large of a pump station that could be supplying up to 140 CFS of potable water to the system, there are special considerations that need to be accounted for. Some of these considerations are maintenance requirements, long lead times for replacing equipment, and this can be as much to 6 to 9 months in advance. Specialized labor requirements for maintaining medium voltage equipment, which we currently don't have that expertise and staff right now to maintain medium voltage equipment. And considerations for future AQM deregulations. There are three options for the pump station configurations as shown in the table. The first option considers pumps that are 20 CFS each, which require medium voltage equipment. The second option is to install 10 CFS vertical turbine pumps. These types of pumps are what we commonly use in the district system. However, if you use 10 CFS pumps, it's much easier for staff to maintain and get replacements parts for, but obviously you can see from the number of pumps, it requires 14 duty pumps with two standby as compared to seven duty pumps presented in option one. The third option is use a combination of 10 CFS vertical pumps and 20 CFS split case pumps. All options are still viable at this point, with the third option providing the most flexibility in operating and maintaining the facility, as well as phasing the increase of supply over time. For the pump station sites, the pump station site is highly dependent on which pipeline alternative is implemented. So if pipeline 2A is implemented, then the preferred pump station site is at Auld Road, just west of Washington Street. This is a Met-owned property. It's PS1 on the figure. If alignment 5D is implemented, then the preferred site for the pump station is on Auld Road and Leon Road, where the district's very close to the district's current Auld Road booster station. Moving on to the cost analysis. So we're going to cover this in two slides. The estimated costs are for the pipelines only. Net present value for the cost of each alternative is shown in the bar chart. The non-met easement alternatives, again, are the first five bars, which represent alternatives 1A through 4C. As you can see by the dash box, the preferred alternatives are highlighted in those. These we're expecting that this is needed by 2030. The last four bar charts are the MET easement alternatives, and 5D, again, is a preferred non-MET. And you can see that the initial phase of implementation for 5D is about $29 million. And as you can see on the bar chart, all the 5 series do have the lowest initial cost to implement compared to the non-MET easement alignments. If you move on to the second and third phase of the project, the MET easement alternatives continue to be the lowest cost alternative. By build-out, however, which is the blue charts on here, the MET easement alternatives are the most expensive alternatives. So there's pros and cons of each of the preferred alternatives, 2A and 5D. For 5D, the benefits are the lower initial costs, being able to use available capacity in the existing Auld Valley 96-inch pipeline initially, and the flexibility to phase in the infrastructure over time, and potentially eliminate phase four, for example, if the Moreno Valley 40 CFS treatment facility is built. Another consideration is that over the next 20 years, we will determine the long-term impact of conservation. And it's possible that the final phase of the 40 CFS supply may not be needed due to lower capital demand. As you can see, that would be a significant reduction in implementing the alternative 5D if we didn't have to do that phase four build-out segment. The benefit of 2A is that it has the lowest overall cost through build-out. If the EM11 facilities need to, in fact, supply 140 CFS of water, it does have the shortest length that it cuts through the interior of the study area. The drawback of alternative 2A is that once you begin implementing this project, there is no longer flexibility to address changing water supply conditions in the future since you're constructing the ultimate size of the pipeline. That is the end of the portion of the infrastructure. Joe or Paul, would you like to comment further?
Sure. Thank you, Laura. So I just wanted to add a couple considerations for the board. Metropolitan has significant capacity available at the Skinner Filtration Plant. And we've been working with Metropolitan over the last 2 years in developing this planning effort. They've been very supportive providing input, and they've been very receptive to our needs. They've indicated that they are willing to work with us to secure the property for the proposed pump station on Metropolitan-owned parcels. In addition, in recent conversations that Paul and myself have had with the Metropolitan senior staff, they've also indicated that they are willing to advance our request to consider transfer of a portion of the easement that they currently have for barrels 1 and 2 to EMWD, as well as potentially the barrels themselves. As you may be aware, San Diego barrels 1 and 2 are no longer in service. In fact, they have been decommissioned for over 20 years. So Metropolitan does not see a need for utilization of those facilities or possibly the easement. Ultimately, they would have to bring that item to their board for consideration to transfer the easements, and John will go into the details. But I just wanted to highlight that it's been a very cooperative effort with Met. As Laura indicated, we see a number of benefits in looking at the metropolitan option in terms of the corridor because of the flexibility. That last tranche of 40 CFS that Laura spoke to, which requires a phase four, it is uncertain that we're going to need it. As Laura mentioned, we're currently looking at the feasibility of potentially constructing another filtration plant in Moreno Valley to address water supply reliability and redundancy in that service area. As we all know, we recently had an outage in Moreno Valley from the Mills plant. So a potential facility or treatment facility in Moreno Valley would address a number of things, including elimination of this last phase. And it's that last phase under the Met option that is the costly component. So we believe that the Met corridor offers a great deal of flexibility, and I just wanted to reiterate that Met has been receptive to us advancing our request. And John will get into some of those specifics as well. But with that, I'll turn it over to the board if they have any questions of Laura, myself, or Paul.
I had a question. You mentioned the pipeline cost is more favorable in 5D. What is the actual – is there a savings using that existing right-of-way, Met's right-of-way, in terms of the construction cost?
Well,
as opposed to the other
go ahead, Joe.
So it's a great point, Dr. Slauson. One of the risks that we saw in the non-Met option, meaning using public right-of-way or potentially private property, is that we recognize that over the next 10, 20, 30 years, as we incrementally construct the project, there's going to be increased development in our service area. There's going to be increased utility interferences, increased conflicts. So there's risk, and that translates into potential added cost. So we did recognize that with the Met easement corridor, that is reserved for Met. There's no conflicts. There's no utility interferences. So we felt that has significantly a risk. It is not going to be possible for us to reserve a alignment in a public right-of-way over the next 30 years for a future pipeline. We're just not going to be able to do that. So to your point, there is increased construction risk associated with a non-Met option.
Well, in actual increased direct construction costs that we would see if we were constructing a 72-inch pipeline in a public right-of-way. I mean, as you know, the way that would be priced by a contractor, the ability, the restricted use of the work zone, the traffic control, all those things add to the overall cost. So, yeah, we haven't specifically quantified that, but I think we certainly could expect that. And as Joe points out, as development occurs and we're looking at the latter phases, there's a distinct advantage to having a cross-country right-of-way set aside where we can work and know that we aren't going to be impacted by the local jurisdictions, their work requirements, use of the public right-of-way, and so forth. And that's one of the big advantages of the Met alternatives. I think the second advantage, as we spoke about, is if you look at the blue bar, yes, you look at 5D and say, wow, if you look at build-out, that's the most expensive option. But it's not clear whatsoever that we would need that last 40 CFS that are represented by the blue bars. And, in fact, we believe water conservation as well as other options that we're looking at for a potential filtration plant in Moreno Valley may negate that need. And in that respect, and if you look at, you could essentially get through, and we show in the orange or yellow bars phase three coming in 2040, that's probably in the 2040 to 2045 time frame. Phase four is sometime between 2045 and 2065. So it's really far out in the future. And we see that the option of 5D, for example, is you have the lowest cost construction that will get you through a 2045 type decision. So, again, we think the flexibility of that to give us options in the future, as well as the avoided construction costs by constructing large diameter regional pipelines in a public right-of-way are very advantageous.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, so John?
With no other questions, we'll hand it off to John.
Thank you, Laura. Cheryl Sanders is our real property manager. She's dialed in. She's working remotely today. Her and her staff have been working directly with Laura and Metropolitan to get this project to its current phase. And her and her staff deserve all the credit for the slides that I'll be presenting here in the next few minutes. So there's a lot of discussion about the easement. I want to point out that the easement varies from 100 to 150 feet in width. The section that we're talking about is roughly 10 miles long. On the graphic on the right side of the slide, you'll see the easement reflected here in purple. And the easement is immediately adjacent to Leon Road right away. And Leon Road, as you know, is a major north-south thoroughfare between French Valley and Winchester and has already been slated to support a lot of the proposed growth throughout that corridor. The other point I want to point out is that the easement is currently unimproved. So it is an easement reserved to Metropolitan Water District, and they do not allow improvements or structures over that easement width. So while we talk about cross-country, it is mostly dirt construction that we would be proposing for this alignment. As we proceed into the acquisition and the easement appraisal phase, I want to point out that we're not currently in active negotiations with Metropolitan Water District. We're solely working with them to understand what might be the value of this easement. The easement crosses over 79 properties with a proposed land use that varies from agricultural, as you see in this image, there's a nursery, to single-family residential. In the lower left is the fine grading occurring for a housing tract currently under construction. Each of those properties have a highest and best final use. We use that highest and best use based on proposed land use to determine what is the across-the-fence value of those properties. That across-the-fence methodology is well adopted in practice for corridor-type property appraisals. And we've deployed that in coordination with Metropolitan Water District in the appraisal methodology you see here. So that across the fence, we'll look at highest and best value of the properties and then derate it for easement use instead of fee title. That appraisal is being conducted by Epic Land Solutions. We expect those early numbers to come in next month, and at that time we'll be able to come back to the board with an updated cost estimate for appraisal acquisition. We've had a number of coordination points with Metropolitan, but one of the most important things is our legal counsel and Metropolitan's legal counsel have determined that the easement rights are transferable. The easement rights were originally assigned to the federal government, who constructed San Diego Pipeline Barrel 1 in the 50s. They were transferred to Metropolitan Water District, and they can and could be transferable to EMWD. Metropolitan staff have determined that one and possibly both of those pipelines should be available for EMWD's use. In fact, a portion of these pipelines have been removed where they cross the right-of-way for Domingone Parkway. I want to point out, too, that these pipelines are in use south of Auld Road, which is south of our study area. Additionally, there is a parcel on the northwest corner of Auld Road and Washington Street currently owned by Metropolitan Water District, and that may be available for the large pumping plant that Laura described. Current status is we are preparing in our final review of the legal and plats that we'll be able to submit to Metropolitan Water District for their review. Our next steps are to formally request Metropolitan's authorization for the transfer of the easement right. That would have to go to MWD board, and if approved by MWD, initiate environmental documentation, develop our key terms for a memorandum of understanding between EMWD and MWD, execute that MOU, proceed to acquire those easement rights, acquire the fee title property for that preferred pump station site, and then advance the preliminary and final design for these proposed facilities. This concludes the presentation. I'll be happy to take any additional questions the board may have.
So the appraisal is based upon the current
general plan land use designations?
It is, and the highest and best use of the surrounding properties as reflected on the current plan, the general plan.
Because we're better off doing it today than doing it 15 years from now because it's all going to change.
Correct. And then, you know, I want to remind you that because it's already an encumbered easement, it would have a significant deduction in value.
And when we discussed this in planning committee, they received this presentation, one of the things we discussed is as the valuations for the easement are brought forward, that and before we get into actual negotiations with Metropolitan on that, we would revisit that with the board and relook at the economics of the projects based on those anticipated values. And, of course, that would be a closed session item because it's real property negotiations.
I would just comment that your team, Laura and Cheryl, have done a great job analyzing the heck out of this, looking at those alternatives. That's very comprehensive, so I appreciate that.
Very good. Any further questions on this item?
Thank you, John.
Thank you, directors.
Okay. Let's go to agenda item 7, which is a receive and file. I'll accept a motion and a second for approval of items 7A through 7B.
So moved.
I'll second it.
Roll call, please.
Director Sullivan?
Aye.
Director Pauly?
Aye.
Director Slauson?
Aye.
Director Record?
Aye.
Director Crona?
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Let's go to agenda item 8, which is the calendar review. Hi, Nicole.
Good morning, President Sullivan, members of the board. I have a very brief calendar review for you this morning. There are no new events to report. Looking at page 2, we have the board's master calendar for the next 2 weeks. Beginning with tomorrow at 7:30 a.m., the board executive committee will meet for Directors Slauson and Sullivan. Director Pauly has been invited to the Murrieta Student of the Month event. It is a virtual event starting at 7:45 a.m. And tomorrow at 3:30, the joint committee meeting with Western Municipal Water District is scheduled. It's a Zoom meeting, Directors Slauson and Sullivan. On Monday,
probably call in. I don't know whether I'll be on the road yet or not. So.
Okay, thank you, Director Sullivan. Noted. On Monday, November 23rd at 4 p.m., the Hemet San Jacinto Water Master Meeting will be held, Director Pauly's calendar. Tuesday, November 4th, the Metropolitan Water District Standing Committee meetings are scheduled. Director Record will attend. Tuesday, November 24th at 3:30 p.m., the Board Ops and Engineering Committee will meet, Directors Slauson and Sullivan. And on Wednesday, November 25th at 7:30 a.m., Director Sullivan has an update meeting with the General Manager in Paris. And Tuesday, December 1st at 9:30 a.m., the SAPA Commission workshop will be held virtually, Director Slauson. And December 1st at 2 p.m., the Rancho California Water District joint meeting with the Eastern will be held virtually, Directors Corona and Record. Moving to page 3, just a reminder, the Aqua Fall Conference virtual event will be held December 2nd and 3rd. And Aqua will be emailing the call information about a week or so beforehand, so we'll get that over to you with the final schedule. The upcoming board and committee and interagency meetings are listed on pages 3 and 4, as well as the district's holiday schedule. Are there any questions or additions to the calendar?
No, just my update meeting with Paul will have to be rescheduled from November the 25th next Wednesday because I probably won't be here.
Okay. I'll take care of that, Director Sullivan. Thank you for the heads up.
Thanks.
That concludes my report. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, let's go to the individual director's calendar reports. Director Corona.
Okay, I attended the Rancho meeting on November 12th. The meeting was preceded by a very long closed session. They reported out of the closed session that they were going to, in regards to an interim management position to replace Jeff Armstrong, they decided to utilized both assistant managers to take up the slack until a replacement manager is decided upon. And that's my report.
Thank you. Director Pauly.
Yes, I attended the annual poster judging contest, where it always hurts my ego to know that third and fourth graders are much more artistic than I am. But anyway, some very good stuff this year. Had my usual good update meeting with the general manager over several topics. Attended the Southern California Water Coalition annual event and awards presentation, which was virtual this year. I think the new chair did a fantastic job of running the meeting. It was a lot of honoring Mr. Keitlinger for all his good work over the years, and including a special surprise visit from Senator Feinstein. And then the keynote speaker was the director of Bureau of Reclamation, and she did a fantastic presentation. So a very, very good evening. And then I was not able to attend the CalDESAL Executive Committee this week.
Okay. Director Record.
Thank you, President Sullivan. Finance and Insurance Committee agenda reviews, nothing special there. Standing committee and board meetings, you have a thorough report prepared by Jolene that's been posted. A couple of things. We had an action item to approve an agreement with Southern Nevada Water Authority to participate in the Carson Recycling Plant, offering $6 million to assist with the environmental with no strings attached, and if the ultimate deal doesn't go forward, meant to repay that money interest-free. It was turned down by the board. It was rather embarrassing, but it will come back probably as soon as next month, and hopefully that passes. MWD meetings, Joint Lending Caucus, Orange County Caucus, over Med Agenda, good meetings. Water Advisory Committee of Orange County. I thought Paul did an excellent job on that panel. And the Southern California Water Coalition annual event, I did not attend that. Sounds like it was a good meeting. Thank you.
Director Slauson.
Yes, I also attended the Water Advisory Committee of Orange County. I think Paul did a very good job. His approach is very analytical, and I didn't see much of that in the from the other commentators. Had the monthly meeting on November 9th with Paul, and that's always enlightening. And we did not have a SAPA meeting on the 17th. However, I did attend the RCCD board meeting. And we approved the auditor's report, had a financial update, reviewed the nominations, and had presentations from the chancellor of the college and from each of the three presidents. That concludes mine.
Thank you. I did attend the MAR briefing with Supervisor Hewitt. I think that Paul did an excellent job. It's amazing to see where the coattails are with some other folks, but it was an excellent presentation. You could tell that Jeff, or Supervisor Hewitt, was paying close attention because he asked some very great questions. I echo Director Pauly's comments on the Water Advisory Committee of Orange County. I thought it was well done. I did attend different sessions on November 10th, 11th, and 12th for National Waterways Conference. One was what they expect out of the new legislative arena that's coming up. I thought it was well done, plus their opening stuff. The National Water Resources Association, there was a couple of excellent meetings. One was some of the stuff that AQUA had participated in on the forestry and the fires and, you know, what it does to California water supplies, not only California, but in everybody in the western states. And then I did attend the Washington, well, I did get, got a nice award from NWRA, which was a, I can't remember the name of the award, the Distinguished President's Award or something. So, and that was, it was very nice to be able to talk to a few folks. And then also I did attend the Washington update from, I thought this year it was extremely well done with Marcus Faust, who's a pretty renowned Democratic lobbyist that represents a number of western states, but primarily Utah and Nevada. And then Christine Arbogast, who is also a Democratic lobbyist, you might say, for basically Colorado and primarily Colorado. And then I can't remember Nelson's last name, who was kind of pinch-hitting from Jason, who left, can't remember the firm's name, one that Jim Ziegler used to be in. They have a number of Republican clients, and, you know, it was well done. They were asking some very pointed questions. Their consensus was that if it is President Biden, that it's not going to be what some people believe it's going to be, because it's going to be so narrow in both the House and the Senate that they'll either get nothing done or they'll get some significant legislation done. They thought that there would be some attention paid to water, and also that they talked about the upcoming Georgia Senate runoff, and they all said, Georgia's a Republican state, I don't care what they say, you know, it's a 70-30 chance that both of those Republican senators are probably going to be elected. It was just, the presidential election was, to a large degree, was more to do with personality than it was to do with policy, and that actually showed in the down ballot races that there was basically not a whole lot of change, and that the Republicans did much better than the Democrats did, and so somebody's going to be paying a lot of attention. So it'll be interesting. You know, we have some odds-on favorite who may, and if it's a Biden administration, who will be Secretary of the Interior. I think I have an understanding who that might be, which I think will bode well for Eastern Municipal Water District, as well as the Commissioner for the Bureau of Reclamation. I think that we'll probably know who that one is, and that bodes well for Eastern, as we have a great deal of credibility with both of those people. So I look forward to keeping in touch and see what happens, and it'll be an interesting reading of the book in the future. All right. Do we have any director's comments? If not, council, we have reason for closed session.
Yes, as identified in agenda item A, the board has a closed session pursuant to Government Code Section 54957 on a public employment matter concerning the general manager.
Do we need to call in again?
Yes. So, Director's Record and Directors Corona and Chelsea, you have the call-in number for the closed session. We'll switch over to that.
Okay.
We'll in the
empty
next
the room. Give
couple
us a
minutes.
Couple of minutes.
So if you could all call into that number, we'll get that set up. Thank you.
Yes. The board met in closed session pursuant to Government Code Section 54957 to discuss a public employment matter regarding the general manager. A discussion was had by the board and no formal action was taken.
Thank you. Okay, with that, do we have any other director's comments or future agenda items? Hearing none, then we'll adjourn the meeting to our regular meeting on Wednesday, December the 2nd, 2020 at 9 a.m. Thank you, everyone, for participating today.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Shayla, we lost Director Corona there at the end.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I'll try to give him a call.